If either of these two beliefs should ever crowd out the other, then he will become that which he completely believes. Until then, he is nothing at all. He is neither the Christ, not yet completely, John Doe. Whether or not he can ever become that which he wishes to be is on the lap of the gods. Few among you have ever been able to intentionally summon up a sufficient amount of concentration to consciously create. But some have, in a moment of great stress, unintentionally attained it. Among the ancient peoples of your planet, the Lemurians were the most skilled in the use of this almost forgotten art of creative thought. The Polynesians of the South Sea Islands are the closest lineal descendants of the Lemurians. It is probable that the most reliable remains of this ancient lore would be found among the natives of Hawaii, however, in spite of the great intermixing with other races. When ancient Mu, or Lemuria, was destroyed, the priesthood fled to the mountains, which are now Hawaii, whereas those on the other islands in the Pacific have descended from the Lesser Lemurians. The colonies of Mu extended eastward to South and Central America, and to the west coast of North America. To the west they included what is now China, India, the Hebraic Assyrian areas, and Upper Egypt. It is quite probable that fragments of their mental sciences would be found among the records of all these peoples. The culture in these colonies was not as high as it was in the motherland, however, and so, with the possible exception of Egypt, if any of the ancient records still exist, the information would not be as reliable as that of Hawaii. The Egyptians were very accurate historians and scribes, and it is probable that their temple records came close to equaling the records of Mu. Unfortunately, however, most of them were destroyed by the Mohammedan invaders. Moses had become a master in the Egyptian temples before he wrote the Old Testament, and carried some of the most important parts of these old sciences forward into the Hebrew religion. Most of it was deliberately written in an obscure manner so that only the initiates could understand it. Large parts were later lost, either accidentally or deliberately, and the remaining parts have suffered greatly in the various translations and revisions. The entire Mediterranean area was originally a colony of the Atlans, who were not particularly skilled in the use of these mental sciences. They did pick up parts of it in their latter days, due to their close cultural ties with the Lemurians in other matters, and fragments of it might remain in the records or customs of these peoples. It is not likely to be either complete or reliable, however. These mental sciences, which you now call Hana, were not necessarily good. As a matter of fact, Lemuria was destroyed by the use of black Hana. Like most civilizations, both ancient and modern, it was based on a master and serf social system. In the latter days, the master class gave itself up almost entirely to sensual pleasures. The condition of the serfs became intolerable. Death offered a welcome relief. They banded together secretly to use their mental powers to destroy their motherland, their masters, and themselves. The physical cause of the catastrophe was the shattered fragments of Aztlan, the former tertiary moon, which crashed into subterranean gas pockets, causing great earthquakes and violent volcanic eruptions. But such things do not just happen. In this case, the downward course of the meteors was influenced by the combined mental efforts of millions of serfs who had lost all hope. Similar events, but on a much smaller scale, have happened before and since. These others were, however, accidental and unintentional. So far as is known, the destruction of Mu is the only instance where such a catastrophe was deliberately caused. After the destruction of Mu, the remaining masters of these sciences banded together in various priestly orders and pledged themselves to keep the law secret from the ordinary people. They were determined that the tragedy of Mu should not be repeated. Initiates were taught the mysteries only after they had been carefully scanned for fitness. Fragments of some of these groups still survive as small occult or religious cults, but most of their information has become badly distorted during the intervening time. Some of the lore has also been handed down among certain inner groups of the Masonic lodges, but the ordinary members are usually unaware of the fact. Considerable research into the ancient Lemurian mental sciences has been done by a group led by Max Friedemelong. It is doubtful that it will gain wide support at the present time. The great bulk of your people are not yet ready for it. The number who have the necessary intelligence and moral character to learn it is small. The main thing, which they can do, is to keep it alive for a more favorable time. It is not merely a matter of revealing the secrets to the students. The process of becoming an adept is much more complicated than this. They must train their minds by long and strict self-discipline. A master can guide them and can give them valuable hints from time to time, but the actual process of learning must, in the final analysis, be an individual and personal one. That which is suitable for one person might be totally unsuitable for another. Each must uncover the facts for himself. Each must develop the particular techniques, which prove to be most effective in his own individual case. The Hana law contains many elaborate rites, rituals and ceremonies, but it is not enough merely to learn these by rote. In themselves, they are of no use whatsoever. The student must look behind their symbolism for the deeper meanings. These things serve merely as a sort of mental checklist to remind the user of things which must be done. For example, much importance is attached to the ceremony of foot washing. The real purpose of this is to remind that humility and self-abasement are essential to the practice of white Hana. There are certain purification rites which are regarded as essential. Yet they are of no avail whatsoever unless they are accompanied by a real spiritual purification of the inner self. Christian Science, faith healing, and their miracle cures at various shrines all employ the basic principles of the ancient mental sciences. In most cases they are used in a crude form, and often instinctively and accidentally rather than intelligently and intentionally. The Christ employed these mental sciences in their most highly developed form in order to heal the sick, raise the dead, and perform all the other miracles which are credited to him. There is nothing supernatural about these things. They were merely the natural results of a science, which is largely unknown to your people of today. He that believeth on me, the works that I do shall he do also. If there is any real secret concerning the mental sciences, it is contained in this statement. The Christ was not referring to himself as an individual. He was using the word me in the much broader sense of the message which he brought and the way of life which he taught. If one sincerely believed on these things, then he would follow them to the best of his ability. Thus the promise is that any and all who follow the Christ's pathway will be able to do all the wonders which he did. As a matter of fact, there is no other way in which one may become adept in the use of white Hana. It is essential that one learn and follow these higher laws. The use of black Hana to harass or destroy an enemy is much simpler, but those who employ black Hana will fall by it. The thing which you call the human mind might be likened to a two-way radio. It both sends and receives. If you tune it to a low level in order to accomplish some unworthy end, then you open the way for low influences from the outside to enter and also do you harm. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. Among those who are studying these ancient mental sciences, the emphasis is usually upon healing. This is, of course, a proper use of this power, since the healing of the sick is a worthy end. Actually, however, this is only one part, and perhaps the least important part of all. As I said in the beginning, the powers of these mental sciences is actually without limit. They could, if their potential was fully realized, accomplish anything, in any field of endeavor. The only thing which prevents the attainment of their full potential is the human limitation of those who attempt to use them. One cannot, of course, ever hope to be entirely perfect in these respects, for only the unnameable is that. Even the great masters are constantly striving to improve themselves. But even on a less than perfect scale, the study and striving will bring rich rewards. When the efforts of several people are combined, the effect is, of course, correspondingly multiplied. Just as the hordes of Lemurian serfs combined their mental talents to destroy their world, so could the people of today combine their talents to remake their world. They could fashion it in any form upon which they agreed. Even today, without waiting to master the mental sciences, they could accomplish great good by jointly concentrating their thoughts and prayers upon certain specified and worthy objectives. Chapter 10 Religion. It had not been my intention to say anything about religion, but it is perhaps impossible for one of my calling to say or write anything without eventually getting Eros into the subject which is closest to me. You may perhaps think that I have already said much on this subject, and, by your standards, this is probably true. The things which I have previously mentioned are not, however, placed in the category of religion by us. We regard them as merely part of the everyday facts of life. You might perhaps also think that, with the removal of all the things which have been previously mentioned, there is not much left for us on the subject of religion. This is not true. As I said before, we study the workings and manifestations of the unnameable intently in order to try to fathom the divine plan, so that we may order our lives accordingly. It is an unending search, for we, as finite creatures, can never hope to fully understand the infinite. We find, however, much pleasure in the close contact with the unnameable which results from our quest, and each new partial success brings us great joy. By contrast with most of your religions, ours would stand out for its simplicity. Our temples are very plain. There is no carving, save one or two symbols which indicate their nature. They are made of materials which are substantial, but of no great intrinsic value among us. For temples are useful only to protect those who worship. Were it not for man's weak nature in the face of the elements, there would be no need for them at all. For who can build a temple which will compare with the great natural beauty all around us? Who can devise adornments which will compare with the handiwork of the Creator and Ruler of all things? These are the things which we gather to admire and adore, not the pale counterfeits of mortal man. The priestly vestments are the same for the most humble neophyte and the high priestess, a plain white toga with no embellishment whatsoever. For the neophytes it is bound at the waist with a common cord, for all others, with a belt of colored material which indicates the wearer's duties. The head and feet are bare, as a symbol of humility. The hair is bound with a simple band of the same color as the belt. Gems are used only to accomplish some practical purpose, not for ornamentation. Whenever I see a church and clergy richly ornamented, with vessels of gold and statues decked with costly gems, the thought comes to me, they have crucified their God upon a cross of gold. They have traded their priceless birthright for worthless trash. If any among us wish to make an offering of the fruits of their labor, they are told not to entomb it, forever sterile, within the cold walls of a temple. They are told, instead, to lay it upon the living altar of selfless service of their fellow men, that it may travel and return manifold. There are no poor among us, so it is not needed by our own people, but there is need in many other worlds. Many of our people who visit your world, as well as many other planets, do so to give of their wealth or services according to some self-assumed obligation. In my previous writings I have made many references to your Christ, and to the Bible of your Christian religion. If it had been desirable I could have cited references from others of your great religions equally as well. They all stem from one common source and we are quite familiar with all of them. The reason for the selection of the Christian religion as an example, is mainly because I am addressing myself primarily to those who follow this faith, and such references would be more understandable to them than those from other sources. I must confess that I also have a certain sentimental attachment for the Christian religion, for I had a small part in its beginnings. I cannot speak with first-hand knowledge of the deeper phases of the coming of your Christ. The project was under the direction of a much higher group than we, although they were not true deities in the strict sense of the word. Our people did, however, have certain assuagements to carry out. I was quite young at the time, and was merely a temple neophyte, but I had the honor to have been selected as one of a large group who were sent to your planet to serve as attendants to Mary, the material mother of the Christ. She was, I might tell you, only a mortal woman, not a deity. But she was much more beautiful, and much sweeter, than any of your artists have ever pictured her. The Christ was virgin-born, as many of your religious dogmas claim, but they go completely astray in assigning the reason for this fact. It was not to eliminate any sin, in the moral sense. Among all the higher peoples, as among the early peoples of your own planet, natural procreation was not regarded as sinful, or nasty, in any way. This error is due to comparatively recent misinterpretations of certain ancient writings. The phenomenon of birth is one of the manifestations of the unnameable, the method devised by it for the perpetuation of a species. No manifestation of the unnameable is ever sinful. The virgin birth of the Christ was selected because it was the most practical and convenient under the particular circumstances of the occasion. When the decision was made to incarnate the entity of the Christ among you, it was decided that he would require a material body of certain characteristics in order to most effectively carry out his mission. It was determined that this would require the mating of a very high plane father with an earth plane mother who had been carefully selected for certain physical and mental characteristics. Due to the very great differences between the two parents, natural mating, while not utterly impossible, probably would have had some very undesirable results. It would have been sinful, in the sense that it was undesirable, not immoral. So a method was chosen which your men of science today would call artificial insemination. Comment. The same is told in the material from Thor, through an UFO contact in the 80THS to a man in Australia. See or search the Thor contact on this same website, and the Mia-Samjay's material, plus in the Lobsang Rampa books. Continues. The matter was much too important to merely sit back and permit nature to take its course, from thence onward. Conditions had to be established and maintained which would be most favorable for the desired results. The physiochemical development of the child had to be constantly watched and, when necessary, guided into the proper pattern. The unborn body had to be carefully protected until the Christ was ready to enter into it, so that no other entity would take possession of it. Since Mary was, as I noted before, merely an earth woman, she knew little or nothing of the mental sciences, which had to be employed to accomplish these things. And so it became our duty, in addition to providing for the material needs of Mary, to constantly stand guard and to combine our efforts and our knowledge of the mental sciences to do these necessary things which she could not do. The rites, which we employed, were strange to the people of those times. Our ability to appear and disappear at will, by raising or lowering our vibrational frequency, mystified them. They concluded that we must be supernatural beings of some sort and called us angels. Had they come to know us better, I fear that they would have found us far from angelic. After the child was born, we worked through the mother to teach it the things which an infant must learn, and to lay the foundation for the knowledge which the real mentors would later impart. When these things were done, our assigned task was completed, but many of us elected to remain on your planet a while longer. Our priestesses are not required to be celibates. Many of us were married to men who had still uncompleted assignments on the same project, and we wished to remain with them. And, aside from this, we had other grand plans lurking behind our star-blinded eyes. As the Christ went through the land, delivering his message, we were planning to work unseen behind him, and gather together into an irresistible force those who had received the message. We were going to lift a whole civilization out of the mire. We were going to save an entire world at one stroke. In our youthful enthusiasm, we would not admit any possibility of defeat. There could be no failure. For had we not foreseen every possible eventuality and provided against it? If only we knew now half as much as we thought we knew then, we would indeed be wise. And then a gnawing thought began to enter our hearts that perhaps we had failed to provide for just one thing, namely, that the people of your world were not yet ready for such a message. But we refused to fully acknowledge the thought. We tried to tell ourselves that it was merely a vagrant and unworthy thought, which we must firmly cast out of our minds. We redoubled our efforts to bend things to our wishes. Finally, events ran to their bitter end, and there could be no doubt that the thing was finished. It was then that all things seemed to come to an end, and we drank the bitter cup to its dregs. Nothing seemed to matter much. We cared not whether we lived or died. But we lived. And we learned. And eventually we came to realize that it was all a part of the divine plan, and that the effort had not failed. For there is a time for sowing, and a time for reaping. And no matter how faithful has been the sowing, the harvest cannot be garnered in, until the seed has sprouted, and grown, and ripened into its full maturity in its own proper and appointed time. One may speak of these things only with great caution, and perhaps I have already said too much. It is difficult to speak the truth without offending those who hold blind and unreasoning allegiance to some particular creed, dogma, or sect. Your earth would be a better place if every creed, dogma, and article of faith were thrown into the sea. When you attempt to reduce principles to writing, and codify them into laws, you open the way for corrupt scribes and lawgivers to distort and misquote them for their own selfish ends. And you open the way for endless contentions as to minor meanings, until the trees of innumerable creeds shut off the view of the forest of truth. It is not necessary that you follow any one variety of religious faith. Nor is it needful that you be a member of any particular church, or for that matter, of any church at all, although the fellowship of a church is usually helpful. But basically and essentially, if any among you wish to become true Christians, you need do only one very simple thing: live like our Christ. And to do this, you need learn only one simple rule. Whenever you are in doubt as to the correctness of any of your actions, look into your Bible to find out what your Christ did under similar circumstances. Then, go thus and do likewise. Chapter 11. The Present Mission. When the elder races developed the material bodies of your ancestors, they assumed, by that act, the moral and karmic responsibility for whatever might happen to them thereafter. Thus, besides the natural obligations of brotherhood, which we regard as among our most sacred duties, we have a special reason for acting as guardians to your peoples. We have been attempting to help and guide the Adamic races ever since their beginnings, and to foster their material, mental, and moral development insofar as it was practical. This is not an easy task. In the final analysis, no one can teach another. He can only place the information before the student, in the proper sequence and according to the student's mental capacity and understanding, and then, by means of various psychological stratagems, attempt to secure the acceptance of this information as fact. The actual learning process is primarily by the route of the student's own experiences, by the process of trial and error. The guiding hand must touch very lightly. The student must be permitted to strike out for himself, for better or for worse. He will never learn if the mentor insists on solving all of his problems for him, and protecting him from the consequences of his errors. As I have said before, we have never been entirely absent from your planet, but we gather there in greater numbers during times of crisis. One of these climactic periods is now upon you. For several years past, your scientific advancement has been becoming more and more unbalanced. Knowledge with a high potential of harm was being discovered before your moral advancement had developed to the point where such knowledge could be properly used. The most important of these was the premature discovery of nuclear fission and fusion, which represents a serious menace to all entities on all planes. The results of your present atomic experiments are not particularly dangerous except to yourselves. They contaminate your atmosphere and will, if continued long enough, make all forms of life extinct on your planet. However, they do not form a great danger to other planes at the present time. It is possible, however, to employ methods which will react with certain constituents of your planet and thus cause its total destruction. The band of asteroids between Mars and Jupiter are the remains of the former planet. Its people, like yours, prematurely discovered the secret of atomic energy, and they also lacked the ethical advancement to use it properly. The result was catastrophic on all planets and planes. It is the possibility that your people might duplicate this tragic event, which is causing us the most concern at the present moment. Many have asked what we are likely to do in the event of an atomic war on your planet. The answer is, nothing, or a great deal, depending on the exact circumstances. First, you must realize that our concept of a catastrophe is different from yours. We are interested in the fate of the world population as a whole more than in the fate of any particular nation or individual. Many events might be tragic for some individual, or even for a whole nation or race. Yet in the larger picture of the total effect on the whole population of your planet, these same events might be very unimportant. While we would not intentionally cause the death of any intelligent being if we could possibly avoid it, we do not regard this passing over as being tragic or evil in itself. That would depend entirely on the circumstances. If a group of your people insisted on cutting their collective throats by means of an atomic war, or by some other means, we might think that they were insane, and that their decision was regrettable. We would, in the spirit of brotherly concern, attempt to dissuade them insofar as our code of ethics permitted us to enter into their affairs. But we would not forcibly restrain them unless the act threatened those on other planets or planes. As I have said before, we recognize the right of every individual to exercise complete free will so long as it does not infringe upon the rights of others, and the right of free will includes the right to be wrong. If your atomic developments should show signs of reaching a dangerous stage, then we might be forced to take some positive action. It should be understood, however, that we do not intend to take any dramatic action, such as taking over your existing governments, or setting up any super-government over them. Nor do we intend to kill or otherwise punish the people of your planet. As I have pointed out before, our code prohibits killing, except as a last and very desperate resort, and there are more peaceable ways of attaining our ends in the present instance. Restraints, whether forcible or unseen, are of only temporary use. The only permanent solution is education, which will raise the mass ethical level of your people. Restraints can never be permanently effective, for some will always find ways of evading them. Taboos are worse than useless. Previous experience indicates that, due to some psychological perversity of the Adamic races, taboos merely serve to glamorize the forbidden thing and make them determined to break the restraints. At the present time, we are keeping careful watch over the relations between the USA and the USSR because war between these two powers is the event which would be most likely to lead to the development and use of dangerous forms of nuclear reactions. Our analysis of this situation is essentially an analysis of facts, and does not include anything which could be regarded as a true prediction. Since we have means of learning all the facts, however, plus the secret intents of the persons concerned, our analysis is probably more accurate than any which your people could make. We consider a conflict between these two powers to be very unlikely in the near future. Remark: this is said in the early 50s. RO. Comment: the rulers of each country fear the retaliatory powers of the other. The USA realizes that, due to the geographical distribution of their population and industry, they are much more vulnerable to attack than is the USSR unless they were able to completely destroy the Soviet Union in one blow, and they doubt their ability to do this. An attack would be suicidal. The USSR, on the other hand, feels that it would be foolish for them to risk the results of a war when they are already doing quite well by infiltrating into local situations. The progress is much slower than military conquest would be, but the Russians have a great deal of Oriental patience. There are unstable elements in both countries, which have powerful followings. If these should gain power in either country, they might blunder their way into war without actually intending to do so. unless and until this seems likely to take place. However, we probably will continue to be merely neutral observers, and will continue trying to raise the ethical level of all peoples.